Today I'm going to talk about the different worlds that the English people who eventually went over to America inhabited before they went to America. And I'm also going to talk about the different worlds that American Indians inhabited before they came into contact with Europeans. So that's the purpose of today's lecture. Native America. America pre-Europeans landing there. It's obviously, a continent. North America is a very big continent. It's much, much bigger than Europe. The people who live there are a lot less densely settled than those who live in Europe. There are no big cities, big towns, which force people into small spaces. People are spread out over the continent in small groups. There's big, usually fairly big gaps between groups. And being a continent, it has a wide variety of climates. It has subtropical climates in the south, in Florida. It has a desert climate in New Mexico and Arizona. It has a very cold, frigid climate in Arctic Canada. And it has sort of every variety in between. So it's very different from Europe, where the climate is reasonably similar. Especially Western Europe is fairly mild, fairly temperate. Doesn't have the same extremes as it does in Native America. Migration to Native America most likely occurred around 30 to 40,000 BC across the Bering Straits, the land bridge which was created by the Ice Age from Asia into the Americas, and the migrants pour in and then they sort of fan out, sort of reaching every part of the Americas fairly quickly. Well, it takes them a few thousand years, but they eventually get to Argentina. And the tribal groupings, which start out probably fairly uniform, gradually diversify into very different formats, most normally dictated by language, by the climate, by the, as I put there, the topography. That's what dictates people's lifestyles. There's no point having a lifestyle around living in very flimsy accommodation when you live in the Arctic. You've got to have some adaptation to your environment, and that's what Native Americans are particularly good at, adapting to their environment. The pre-Columbian population of North America is just pure guesswork, and estimates range from about 1 million to up to 10 million, and you will read everything in between, but they are all pretty much guesswork. There are clearly not as many people living in North America, though, as there are living in Central and South America. And this map shows you just some of the variety of Native Americans broadly grouped here, color-coded, into, I suppose, lifestyles. The eastern woodland lifestyle here is sort of the whole of New England and the Great Lakes region. And that just says those people live fairly similar lifestyles because they live in a fairly similar climate. Southeastern Indians, again, they live in a different environment, therefore they're different. But that doesn't mean that they're actually, that these tribes are completely similar or they even speak the same language. In fact, they usually don't speak the same languages. But this shows you roughly the distribution of tribes which Europeans would have encountered in around 1500. And I say they're very rough regional things. But some of the Indian names that we will come up against soon are things like Powhatan in Virginia, the Narragansett, the Wampanoags in New England, the Iroquois, which is part of that confederation of five tribes in what is now upstate New York. Then in the south, big tribes such as the Creek and the Cherokee and the Chickasaw also. That's quite significant for early America. The big mistake you can make is to lump all Indians together as, the Indian, or there is a typical Indian, because there isn't a typical Indian. They're all different. They not only speak different languages, they have different religions and cultures. And you can get Native American tribes that are completely nomadic and live a hunter-gatherer existence, and you can also get Native American tribes that are settled, agricultural, not that different from European peasantry. And you get everything in between. And there are some very small tribal groups where they're no more than, say, 50 or 100 individuals. And others are thousands of individuals living quite densely settled in parts of the country. And also, you know, Native Americans don't see themselves as Native Americans. It's very easy for us to talk about the encounter between the European and the Native American. But, you know, that never happened. What you got was an encounter between very different types of Native Americans and very different types of Europeans. And Native Americans fairly soon suss out that the English and the French and the Dutch and the Spanish are all quite different sorts of people, and they treat them differently. And also, the English figure out that they can, you know, get on with some Indians and not with others, and they can use one Indian against the other. And that's because those sorts of conflicts, those intertribal conflicts, have been going on for millennia. And for some Native American tribes, that's the whole purpose of their existence, is to fight other Native American tribes. So there's never a pan-Indian view about anything. There's lots of different, divergent, conflicting viewpoints. And it's something you just need to be cautious of, I think, when reading about Native Americans and Native American tribes. England, by contrast, of course, is not a continental landmass. It's a very small island. It probably fits into, you know, Lake Michigan, with a bit left over. It's comparatively overpopulated. The population of England alone is far greater than most estimates of what the population of North America is at this period. England has internal divisions. It also has external conflicts. You know, it has that sort of nation-state issue. But England has a long history of being a country. By this time, it's had 500 or 600 years of being a country or a nation. English is the common language, even though there are dialects that linger, you know, especially in the West Country, places like that. But English is widely spoken, obviously. And there's the beginnings of a nascent national culture. And certainly compared to previous centuries, the 16th century, the era of the Tudors, is the era of the nation-state, where the nation-state becomes a lot more powerful. And England is also an ambitious power. In the 1500s, it's very much small fry compared with Spain, compared with France, compared with the Holy Roman Empire in European affairs. But it wants to be up there playing with the big boys, and it thinks it can do it. And so part of this story is about England's transformation from being marginal and peripheral on the edge of Europe to being very, very significant internationally. The English government, well, hasn't changed very much in the last 500 years. At the heart of government is the monarchy and the two houses of parliament, the House of Lords and the House of Commons. Unlike today, when the most important of those three is the Commons, in the 16th century the monarchy is the most important, followed by the House of Lords, followed by the Commons. And the 16th century is an era of great resurgence of the power of the monarchy in Britain, with Henry VII and then Henry VIII. But it's not difficult to be, you know, more powerful as a king in the 16th century than it had been in the 15th century, because the Wars of the Roses have been absolutely devastating for the country in the 15th century. So you get more and more power and patronage concentrated in London and issuing out from London. And there's a lot less regionalism and power to the regions than there had been. The great offices of state, Lord Chancellor, Lord Chamberlain, are all held by Duke of this and Lord of that and Earl of so-and-so. The role of the Commons is basically to grant taxes to the king. They don't get much chance to say no, but they do at least get a say. However, you know, women aren't allowed to vote, obviously. You don't have crazy things like letting women vote. And you have to be a property-holding adult, male. So the franchise is actually quite limited. And I'll talk a little bit more about the social structure of the country, so you understand just how limited it really was. Of course, in America, they don't have, you know, kings. They might have leaders, but they don't have kings. They don't have structures of government like they do in England. It's much more personal, it's much more local and simplified, and Whereas in England, there's a primacy based on birth, partly because of the monarchy and the nobility. In America, that's not that important. You get the several tribes in America where children gain all their social status from their mother, not from their father. And then marry into important families, rather than the other way around. And there's also quite a lot of rich American societies that are meritocratic, where you can rise to be a famous chief or a famous leader on the basis of your war record. If you were a great warrior and you led your people successfully in battle, that raises your social status and raises your prestige and you become very important and so on. So it is possible to rise from obscurity in Native America to prominence. In England, that's a lot more difficult to do. Not impossible, but a lot more difficult. And here is Henry VII, winner of the Wars of the Roses, victory at Battle of Bosworth and the death of Richard III. And his famous William Cecil, who was Secretary of State for Queen Elizabeth for 40 years, great politician, very Machiavellian figure in some respects, quite an important man. England is a very stratified society, and at the top are the nobility, the landowners, and they get their money from owning land. And one historian has estimated that about 9,000 great landowners controlled around half the wealth of the entire kingdom. That's really what you call concentration of wealth in the power of a few, when you've got a population of England that is, you know, several million. And of course, if you have wealth, it's very easy to generate more wealth. The richer you are, you know, money buys you favours, it buys you patronage, it buys you an education, it might buy you a place at court, it might buy you a commission in the army, whereby you'll generate, you know, your own position of power and prestige as well. It's not a completely static elite. You can make money in other ways, for example, by being a merchant, and you can become ennobled. You can make money, make your name through martial feats as well, I mean, again, leading people in battle, but again, can raise you up. But it is still a very, very small group of people. You know, perhaps like, you know, 0.5% sort of thing. Around a third of the population you could broadly describe as the middle classes. And the middle classes in early modern England, we're talking about freeholders, people who own their own land, traders, as in merchants, but not really rich merchants, craftsmen who own their own businesses, yeoman farmers, who again would own a reasonable number of acres, and they'd be independent people. They are not struggling. These people are, you know, are established individuals or families. But they're also fairly flexible people. They're looking out for self-improvement and familial improvement. They want to move out into new places, find places where they can make more money or more economic security. And a lot of them actually travel to America. They're quite a mobile group. And that's partly because some of them reach this sort of glass ceiling where they can't progress any further in the UK, and they want to travel beyond that to you know, broaden their opportunities. But although a third of the population is middle class, you can also divide that between the rural and the urban middle classes. And the urban middle class is doing quite well. As towns and cities grow, there's more demand for merchants, more demand for that sort of trading work, more demand for artisans. Whereas the more the cities grow and take a greater share of national wealth, the less important the rural areas are, and the yeoman farmers, those sorts of people are getting less less power, less significance. And we're seeing the beginnings, I guess, of a long-term trend away from rural areas into urban areas. And so if you're left in rural areas, you can begin to feel a bit of like the rural poor. Even though you might own quite a lot of acreage, you can begin to not feel as if you're in a dynamic part of the economy, certainly. Below the middle classes are a group you call the lower middle class, who are what's termed cottagers, rural areas, people who would own a small holding, a very small, small holding, you know, half an acre sort of thing, where you might raise chickens, you might have the odd goat, grow a few vegetables. You'd be reasonably self-sustaining. And in urban areas, people who worked for somebody else, they just about got by. They weren't rich, they weren't comfortable even, they were just about making do. The people who nowadays would be receiving, you know, tax credits and this sort of thing, but they are often, you know, usually working. The problem with these people is that the slightest hint of economic trouble, and they're the ones who bear the brunt of it. They're the ones who lose their jobs first. They're the ones where, if the harvest isn't good, they go hungry. They don't have the surplus to tide them through bad times. And the one thing about the early modern period is that there is quite a bit of movement between the classes. You've got the middle classes that are probably shrinking a bit. You've got some at the very top moving into the aristocracy. You've got a reasonable number at the bottom who are slipping down a bit, the rural middle classes who are slipping down into the ranks of the sort of broader poor. And the lower class is generally growing. And it's about half to two-thirds of the population you would classify as poor. And the lower classes are people who have to work. People have to work for somebody else. They are hired labour. They are seasonal labour. And they really do struggle when times go hard. They're forced into vagrancy, into begging, and poor relief. There's no surprise, there's no coincidence that the Elizabethan Poor Law, which, you know, became gradually more systematic in the 1590s and in the early 1600s, was partly the response to this growing problem of vagrancy and poverty. The poor are especially mobile. They wander from place to place, looking for work, or just looking for the next meal. They commit crime. They are a real problem. And that's partly because they're sort of dislocated. In the early modern period, everyone had roots, everyone had a home, everyone was supposed to sort of stick to their place in society, and the poor don't follow that script. They sort of make it up as they go along, and they sort of wander around the countryside being a nuisance. And a lot of people are very worried and frightened about what the poor do. And this is the reason why there's tighter and tighter regulations about the movement of the poor and where they can live and what they can do in this period. But they are perhaps the largest social class in early modern England. Although urban communities are growing, rural communities are some of the most, by far the most common types of communities in early modern England. And there are four types of rural community, all of which are quite distinct. Firstly, there's the unenclosed farming community, where you've got lots of fields held in common. They grow lots of different types of crops. There is a local lord of the manor who would be very significant. He didn't determine what people grew, but people usually had to give him a portion of their crop. He might even own some of the land and let people use it, rent it out to them. He would dominate that type of economy. But that's a really sort of medieval type of landholding and land system. So it's actually in decline in the early modern. Secondly, there's the enclosed arable type of community. Growing crops, but fields are enclosed. They're divided up for individuals. You've got a growing number of wage labourers employed by the Lord of the Manor. So Lord of the Manor, his influence and position is growing in this type of community. You've got increased differentiation, stratification between rich and poor in this type of community. And this type of community is expanding because there's more and more unenclosed communities being enclosed. This is a trend that continues over the next 200 years where farmland is enclosed and common land is, you know, controlled by individuals. The third type of community is enclosed pasture land where they farm, you know, sheep, well, mainly sheep. This one doesn't need as many people because you don't need as many people to look after animals as you do to tend crops. You don't need to do the hoeing, the ploughing, all that sort of stuff which takes a lot of labour. you've basically got to, you know, milk the cows and feed them, and that's about it. Or milk, you know, shear the sheep. You know, there's actually not as many people need it. And it, these areas become the sources of migration into the towns because the population can't get work, and therefore they feed into migration. But also these people don't always go into towns, they sometimes disperse into even more remote areas like woodlands and fenlands and moorlands. And this area is growing particularly quickly in the early modern period. Sheep is a really big commodity in the Tudor, in Tudor England, and there's a lot of money to be made from wool. So more and more people are kicking people off the land and growing, farming sheep instead. Fourthly, finally, there's the unenclosed non-farming land. So this is just everywhere else. So farm, the land that's not being used for farming. And big areas such as the Fenlands of East Anglia, Cambridgeshire, the Yorkshire Moors and the Yorkshire Dales, the Scottish Borders, you could add the Welsh Marches to this, parts of the West Country. These big areas absorb some of these excess people from these areas which are becoming closed. But it's much more of a free and easy, you know, slightly hippie-ish existence. Mostly there aren't any laws of the manor because this land isn't seen as very productive. There's no money to be made out of this land. But people who live there can eke out an existence out of this landscape. Just enough to get them by. But not enough to make you rich or make money out of it. But it makes for a society that's quite egalitarian, which is quite unusual in early modern England. Most societies are very hierarchical, but these sorts of areas tend not to be quite so hierarchical. And other types of person than the lord of the manor become much more significant in these communities. People like priests and village elders. These are the crucial people. And it's these types of communities that provide a lot of migrants. Because the ties that bind people to their place, as in work, a lord of the manor, a tradition, they're fairly absent in these communities. People don't have the same things pinning them down, and therefore they move. By contrast, in Native America, there's very little formal hierarchy, lords of the manor, you know, controlling people, what people do, controlling what people grow, controlling where they grow things. Those things don't exist in America. Wealth doesn't really translate into social status, because a lot of things are held in common, you see. And therefore, age and marital status, family links, they're all more important than how much land you have access to. And if you hold positions in common, then there's not really a big emphasis on private property. It's not how much, you know, land you personally control. It's about providing for your family, or it's about, you know, being successful in warfare. It's about showing your skills in various different ways. And so you become a chief and you hold power, partly because of military power, personal prowess, but also by family connections through your sisters, your cousins, your mother's family. Those sorts of important people, sort of, that aura spills over onto you as well. But it is, as I said before, it's a bit more of a meritocratic society. You can rise through these ranks. And you get quite a lot of Native American societies, in contrast to any European society, have a lot more influence given to women. You get women who attend councils, tribal councils. The elders can include women when they discuss things as a tribe, discuss issues, decisions to go to war. Those sorts of things for women are quite significant. There are some Europeans who later travel through Native American societies, and they remark on the fact that, you know, sometimes it's the women who are the most gung-ho about going to war, Maybe partly perhaps because they're not the ones that are going to go to any fights. Oh yes, you know, you all can go out and fight, we'll stay at home. But they're also the ones who would sort of impose this culture of masculinity on Native American men, shaming those, it's very shameful not to be brave and strong. And something that happens in a lot of Native American society is that if you're captured as a prisoner of war, you'll be tortured to death. But it's a matter of personal and tribal pride to not cry out in pain. And it's the women who torture the captives, trying to sort of dishonour them, emasculate them. And it's not the men who are to do the torture, which is slightly perverse. And here's an example of a Native American woman, just one I happen to have lying around. There are lots of problems in England that the English are dealing with in the 16th century. Firstly, overpopulation. The English population doubled in the 16th century. Even in the 1630s, only about 10% of what it is now. But it's still a big leap in 100 years to double your population. And of course, if you double the population, you've got to feed all those people. And the pressures are particularly acute near London, where the population is concentrated. You do get better techniques of crops, of better farming techniques, particularly in England, where they learn how to get more grain per acre by learning new seeding techniques from the Dutch and new varieties of corn that have better yields, all sorts of things. Which means that people aren't starving in the streets, but there's not a time of plenty either. And a rising population that is squashed together in small spaces also becomes a lot more vulnerable to disease. Fires, just after this period, of course, in 1666, is the Great Fire of London, where a significant part of London is destroyed. Hundreds of people are killed. Disease epidemics, the plague, of course, is endemic in Britain. You get bad harvests. And that's because if you are not well fed and you are slightly weakened, then you are much more likely to succumb to these types of diseases. As I put there, in that 150-year space, there's only 12 years where you don't get bubonic plague outbreaks in England. And you also get something called the Little Ice Age in the 1620s, whereby a lot of harvests around Europe failed or were very poor, and of course that meant yields went down and people went hungry. This was before the age of Tesco, where you could just go in and say, well, our crops haven't been good this year, so we'll buy all our crops from South America or somewhere. These things didn't happen. There's no global economy here. Food miles are very short. So you grow something, you eat it, or you buy it at your local market. And that's about the limit of how far food travels. Other problems. Inflation. Inflation, we all have inflation. We've always lived with inflation. What's the big deal about inflation? Well, it's relatively new in the 16th century. And at 3%, it means that prices are consistently rising. And they're rising, as always, faster than wages are rising. And therefore, what's happening is that people are becoming poorer for no apparent reason. Prices are going up, rents are going up, their wages aren't staying the same, therefore they're becoming poorer. So this is a big problem, especially for the poor, obviously. And you've also got a rise in unemployment. You've got a declining cloth market in the 16th century, which is the mainstay of the English economy, especially the export economy. In this period, and it particularly affects southwest England and also East Anglia. And is it any surprise that these two regions supply a lot of migrants to America? Some of their economic reasons for staying at home are being weakened just by market forces. So you've also got this sort of structural shift in the economy away from agriculture. And a good example of that, is the fact that in 1500 the richest man in England was a cloth merchant, and 150 years later, the richest man is a coloniser, an Irish coloniser.
We'll talk about Ireland next week. So you've got between a quarter and a half of the English population really living on the breadline, where you know, the merest thing tips them into the balance, tips them over, you know, the brink into real poverty. And of course, poverty, as is always the way, affects particularly the young and the very elderly. Don't think about the very, I haven't mentioned the very elderly here, you don't live very long in England, you don't live to be very elderly. Whereas the young, people in their teens, early 20s, are the ones hit hardest because they lack the skills. They're not master craftsmen, they can't earn money that way. They don't own land. These are the most mobile, vulnerable people. They're disproportionately the people who travel abroad. By contrast, in America, you don't have money. You don't have money, you can't have inflation. The population is more than sustainable on with the resources that are available. In fact, the population could have been significantly greater and been sustainable. You don't have jobs, so you don't have any employment. You certainly haven't got land pressures, land is plentiful. You've got a disease environment that is stable, at least. You don't have epidemics, until Europeans arrive, of course, and then those epidemics really kick off. But in the 17th century, there's no real disease problem until Europeans come. And food is plentiful. The main threat to survival and the main check to the population of Native American tribes is actually warfare. They're too busy killing each other. Another really significant problem that's affecting England and indeed the whole of Europe in the 16th century is the Reformation. You've got the start of the Reformation in 1519, which is all Martin Luther, his 95 Theses on the door of Wittenberg Cathedral. I'm sure you'll learn all about that if you're doing European World this year, if you're a SES student and you're not doing European World. There's a brief potted history about what Luther said. And why Luther was so controversial. He's making theological arguments on the one hand, but he's also making very practical arguments. I mean, it's all very well to have a debate about justification by faith, which is quite esoteric and most people wouldn't understand. It's another argument to say, look at all these fat priests and all these monks and these nuns living it in the life of Riley while you all live in poverty. You know, that's quite a populist message, which a lot of people think, oh yeah, hang on a minute, how come these monks have got so much food and so much wine? They're not living, you know, the pure life of the early monks who all, you know, spent most of their life living on poles. Here they are, it's, you know, they're sponges on society. They're not productive. All they do is take our money and live it up. And within 30 years, you've got a huge division in Europe. Over religious faith. And by mid-century, most of Germany and Scandinavia has become Protestant. And you've got a weakening papacy, but you get a resurgence of Catholicism in the Counter-Reformation towards the end of the 16th century. And there's a lot of religious tension and religious wars in Europe over the next sort of century. And there is Luther looking very happy. In England, Henry VIII originally defends the papacy from the Reformation, and he's even given the title Fidei Defensor by the Pope. If you look at your coins in your pocket, they still have the words FD next to the Queen, and that's so she still carries the title Fidei Defensor, Defender of the Faith, which is very sweet because he was given to Henry VIII by the Pope. But this all falls apart in the 1530s because he wants to divorce Catherine of Aragon, who hasn't given him a son. You know, partly because he wasn't actually sleeping with her very much. But the Pope says he can't divorce her and marry someone else. And eventually, he splits with Rome, and forms his own church with himself as the head, and then he grants himself a divorce. Which is very handy, being head of your own church. But one thing you should remember from this is that you should never see Henry VIII as a Protestant. He's not really that interested in theology at all. He's basically a schismatic Catholic. He wants to do what he wants, do his own thing. He doesn't really care what the Pope says. And that's different from being a Protestant. He goes through five other wives, as I'm sure you all know, and has two other children, the youngest of whom is Edward VI, who succeeds his father. He's only, I think, nine or ten when he succeeds as king in 1547. And so the country is run by various nobles as a regent, as regents for Edward VI. And they turn the Church of England into a properly Protestant church. Problem is that Edward dies at the age of 16, and he's succeeded by his much older sister, Queen Mary, who is actually married to King Philip II of Spain, and she immediately turns England back into being a Catholic country. So, having had 6 years of fairly staunch Protestantism, you sort of flip-flop and have 5 years of quite extreme Catholicism, when she spends most of her time persecuting Protestants, burning them at the stake. I mean, and not for... but there's no surprise that she earns the epithet Bloody Mary, because she quite enjoys persecuting people. And all this time, her sister, younger sister Elizabeth, swears blind that she's a Catholic, and promises her sister that she is the best Catholic ever, and she's going to be the staunchest Catholic queen when she succeeds her sister. Mary then kicks the bucket in 1558, and Elizabeth becomes queen and says, like, "Ah, well, I was only joking, and I have my fingers crossed behind my back. And actually, we're going to be Protestant again." And so, within 10 years, they flip-flop twice. And it's just really, really confusing for everybody. And there's real instability there. Elizabeth finally brings to some religious stability to Britain, because she reigns for the next sort of 40-odd years. And that's quite significant. But she herself generates instability towards the end of her reign, because she never marries, she never has an heir, and it's who becomes king or queen after Elizabeth that becomes a really crucial issue in the 1590s, especially. But in the first years of her reign, she's actually a force, very much for stability. There is the classic portrait of Henry VIII, painted by Hans Holbein, with him in his sort of fat, gouty mode. I can't imagine what his wife thought of him when he was that age. I can't believe it was a particularly attractive figure. Especially Catherine Howard, who was only about 18, I think, when she married him, and he was about 50, or maybe even older. Just a tiny bit gross. There is Queen Mary, looking suitably severe, I think. She doesn't have to look fierce, if she's saying, go on, roast another Protestant for me. And there is Philip II of Spain, King Consort of Mary Tudor. And of course, as soon as Mary dies, he says he's going to marry Elizabeth. He offers to marry Elizabeth, but she's a bit too canny for that, and says no. And 30 years later, he sends the Spanish Armada, of course, against Elizabeth. They have a bit of a falling out later on. But Philip II is quite an interesting figure in European history. Son of Charles V, hugely wealthy man, has all the wealth of the Incas and the Aztecs flowing into Spanish coffers, and yet in 1576 the Spanish state is bankrupt. He's spent every penny of it, and that's really quite an achievement. That's a real serious blowout, to spend several billion on pretty much nothing, so much so that the Spanish army has to sack Antwerp in order to get paid. But that's what they do when you're a rampaging army. You just go and sack some city, and then that's how you get paid. And there is a classic portrait of Elizabeth I. The last of the Tudors, of course, she would be succeeded by her cousin, James, King of Scotland, who was the first Stuart king. But she's quite a significant figure in English history, especially in this period, because she's so important. She reigns for 45 years, which is pretty much one of the longest reigns up until then, I think. And she has a lot of contacts, a lot of control over English expansionism, which I'll talk about a bit more next week. So, what can we learn from this? 16th century English society is overpopulated and under-resourced. It's not a very nice place to live. You have pretty much no chance, or minimal chance, of improving your life. You're fairly stuck where you are. There's very little social mobility. The economy is, going down the toilet. And you've got religious anarchy going on, where you don't know whether this week you'll be persecuted for believing the wrong thing. In North America, none of these things exist. And the clash of those two societies, two completely divergent, almost antithetical societies, in first of all the 1580s and then early in the 1600s, is really cataclysmic. And these East Coast tribes that have been living their existences pretty much unchanged for thousands of years really wouldn't know what hit them. They can't see what's going to come. And there's no really real way they could have prepared for it. So different to those two societies.